listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this live broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the emotionalpro.com radio page. And also feel free to call in on our toll-free number, 800-630-7858. That's 800-630-7858. And you can talk directly with me or our guest. So how stressed are you feeling these days? Are you living in fear that your income may disappear, your home be foreclosed, or that your car won't last until you can afford a new one? And if you're stressed, what are you doing about it? Perhaps you've been to the doctor and you're now taking anti-anxiety medication, which may be working, yet has all those side effects that the medication commercials on television tell us about in those low tones. What if there were a better way to deal with stress? One that not only helped with the stress, but also opened you to a lifetime of feeling alive, centered, able to handle whatever fear arises, and positive in your outlook? And what if this way allowed you to feel integrated, a complete mind, body, emotions, and spirit person without negative side effects? Such is the promise of mindfulness. First introduced to the U.S. in the early 1970s, mindfulness has recently jumped into the mainstream, and no doubt, because of that, you've heard of it. Perhaps you've taken classes on mindfulness, or maybe you even teach it. Today, we're exploring mindfulness, what it is, what's involved in practicing mindfulness, and how you can find out more about it for yourself. Our guest today is Bob Stahl, co-author of a new book that can open the portal to mindfulness for you, entitled A Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook. Bob Stahl, PhD, can be found at mbsrworkbook.com and mindfulnessprograms.com. He founded and directs mindfulness-based stress reduction programs in 5 medical centers in the San Francisco Bay Area. A longtime mindfulness practitioner, Stahl has completed MBSR, that's Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, teacher certification at University of Massachusetts Medical Center, and has lived in a Buddhist monastery for more than 8 years. Stahl also serves as an adjunct senior teacher for OASIS, the Institute for Mindfulness-Based Professional Education, at the Center of Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. And Bob Stahl, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you very, very much for having me on your show. Nice to be here.
I'm glad to have you. So more and more people are hearing about mindfulness. I know corporations and schools are hosting mindfulness training programs, for example. So let's start by having you say exactly what mindfulness is, please.
Yes, thank you. And mindfulness is a practice of learning to be more present in our moment-to-moment, day-to-day life. There's an expression sometimes, taking our lives one day at a time, but in mindfulness, it's really taking a look at each moment at a time. And there is often times in our lives that we're not that present to what's actually happening in the present moment. Maybe even the listeners listening to this show might be doing other things. And so we do multitask, so that's not a problem, but the sense of mindfulness is an intentionality about really being present to what's happening here right now. So, for example, if we're eating or walking or doing different activities of day-to-day living, we're actually learning how to be more present in these moment-to-moment experiences, pardon me, that we have. Often we live in the world of rehearsing or rehashing of future events or past events and missing what's happening now. So the attitude of mindfulness is this quality of non-judgmental awareness. It helps us to be present to exactly what is here.
Why is it important to be non-judgmental?
Well, it's actually difficult to be non-judgmental, so I'll back up a moment on that. But the quality of mindfulness is this faculty of awareness, is just seeing things as they are. For example, a meteorologist is reporting the weather. It's cloudy, it's sunny, it's still, it's hot, it's cold. There's a certain element of an impartial observation to what is actually happening. And so we employ that part of that aspect to also to mindfulness. So, for example, if I'm feeling stressed, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling happy, this is matter-of-fact acknowledgement. This is what is actually in the weather condition inside our own body and mind. So if I happen to see that I'm actually non-judgmental, in that moment when one becomes aware, then there's the matter-of-factness, oh, here's non-judgment, or here's judgmentalness arising in the mind.
So is that like becoming the observer then? You're just observing what you're doing? You're not evaluating it?
Well, to some degree, but I'd also say that it's more of a fusion of a participant observer, because we're also engaged in the activity. So we're eating the strawberry, and we're aware that we're eating it, and then if the experience is there's a pleasant feeling, pleasant taste, we're aware of the pleasant taste, and so forth. So we're allowing ourselves to experience and be present to what's here.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. It seems like a pretty simple concept, just staying present in the here and now and being conscious in the present. What's difficult about it?
What's difficult about it is, we could stop for even like 10 seconds right now. Maybe we don't want to have a lot of blank space on the radio here, but even for very short periods of time, if we begin to stop and try to attempt to be present, we'll see that it's actually very difficult, that our mind is rehearsing about future events or plans or what we want to be doing or dreading. The mind is perhaps recollecting and rehearsing past events. It's very difficult to actually be present. And that's one of the very first insights we get when we begin to practice more mindfulness of trying to be more present. We realize how much our mind is either in the future or the past. Perhaps that's why John Lennon, the Beatle, once said, life is what happens while we're busy making other plans. A lot of the time, we're hardly ever present to what's happening. So even though the concept in some ways is very simple, just be here now, when we actually really attempt to do that, it's very difficult to stay present. And we see how that our mind is going off into future and past events.
Would that be one of the reasons that people might resist mindful living, that it seems really too hard to do?
We actually consider it to be more of a practice. And, we will not be mindful every single moment of our waking consciousness, but the more that we can bring mindfulness into the moments that we have, we might actually experience life to be a little bit richer. Because when you really consider it, the only moment that we actually ever really live in is the present moment. The future has not yet come. The past has gone by. And of course, as we're living in the present moment, it's going to help us to see more clearly what is actually happening here. And then from that space, we can begin to make constructive choices on how to respond to the different challenges that we're living with, rather than perhaps with, if we were unaware, reacting from old unconscious habitual patterns that could potentially be very counterproductive or even destructive to our health and our well-being. We feel that mindfulness plays a very strategic role in stress management because it helps us to see where it is that we are. For example, maybe the listeners are actually in a driving right now and they're in a traffic jam. And if we're not that mindful, we may begin to react to the traffic jam in ways that are unhealthy to our own body and mind. We may begin to grasp the steering wheel so tightly that our knuckles are turning white and it's forcing all the muscle skeletal tension with body. We're beginning to get irritated and anxious and angry, and we begin to breathe more rapidly and more irregularly. It's forcing our heart rate and blood pressure, temperature for our body to arise, and often we're not even aware that we're doing these things to ourselves. Once we become mindful, once we become aware, we have a choice. So actually, there's a very beautiful quote from Viktor Frankl that says that between the stimulus and the response, there is a space, and in that space lies my freedom. We don't at times recognize the spaces between our reactions because we have so much impulsive reactivity, so much habitual strong patterns. But once we, for example, become aware or mindful that we're holding tightly on the steering wheel and that we've got into this full-blown stress reaction in this traffic jam, once we become aware of that, we have a choice. Oh, I can loosen the grip on the steering wheel. I can begin to try to calm down my breathing that will bring my heart rate and blood pressure, temperature of my body back into regulation. Once we become aware, we have choice. If we're not aware, we may be governed by our own habitual patterns.
Mm-hmm. one of my learnings is that the only time we have power is in the present. And I'm a marriage and family therapist, and often people will come in and they're complaining about their spouse or significant other, and if they're there together, they want to build all the reasons why the other person isn't doing well. And I challenge them and I say, we can spend your time and money living in the past here, or we can talk about now what's happening and look at what you want for the future. And it seems to me that then what you're talking about in mindfulness is also taking power over your own life. Would you say that's so?
Yeah, often in our terminology, we don't necessarily use the word power, but I would definitely equate to the sense that we do have this freedom of choice. And that is power. That's empowering to realize right. that we actually, there's an old mindfulness axiom, actually comes from the Buddhist teachings, that says that the mind is the creator of our own heavens and our own hells through our own thoughts. And so it's really lying the responsibility. If indeed our mind is indeed the creator of our own heavens and our own hell through our own thoughts, then we need to take responsibility for our mind, for our thoughts, and what we sow. And there's actually a beautiful Native American teaching story of an elder that once was reported, "Feels like that which lives inside me is two dogs, and one is mean and one is sweet. And the mean one keeps on picking fights with the sweet one." And someone asked the elder, "Well, which dog usually wins?" And the elder said, "It depends on which one I feed." Mm-hmm. And so this quality of which one I feed, it does involve choice. And so from, in the regards with what you're saying with power, I think it is very empowering to see that we have a choice on how we can respond to any situation. We may not be able to change the situation, but we have a choice in how we can respond to it.
Yes. How important that is. Well, certainly stress is something people nowadays know more about than they know about mindfulness. And stress actually happens because we go on alert for danger so much of the time that we can't turn that danger button off, like our ancient ancestors who could turn it off once the tiger attack threat had passed. Is that basically what is stressing? Why stress is so important today? Is because we're under stress so consistently?
Well, I think from the time millennium, there's been stress since the first human beings. Once there was the realization that we could not any one of us could escape from time to time from difficulties and uncertainties, and of course the inevitable that we cannot escape from aging, we cannot escape from illness, we cannot escape from death, we cannot escape from separation. I'm not trying to paint a dark picture here, but these are the realities of life. And actually, when we even consider death, death is the great gift that gives the preciousness to life. If there was no death, it would get boring after a while. But these stressors, these are like fundamental, essential stressors that all live with, is aging, illness, and death. And of course, it's compounded in our culture and times by the threat of terrorism and global warming and, the recession. And I mean, and also with the use of technology, we are bombarded with information 24/7, 365. When I grew up, at least the stores were closed on Sundays. And
me too.
Bombarded with all of this information. And, sometimes we'll do a mindfulness exercise to take a look at what you take in. And sometimes I'll hear people report, I realize that the last thing I take in before I go to bed is the news, and I'm beginning to make a connection. That's why I can't sleep at night. Like mm-hmm. Our diets of what we take in, consumption of trauma and the negativity that's arising on a global scale that we could find out almost in minutes. I mean, I was shocked some years ago during the Gulf Wars that, that we could watch on CNN live the war. It was the actual war. We can watch it live. And, the sense of the conveying of the traumas of what goes on in the diet that so many of us take in is a diet of trauma. Of course, we have, again, we're aging, we're becoming much more educated and aware of this tension that we're living within and needing to find some balance. And often, of course, these types of feeding of the trauma is helping to support catastrophizing or worrying about what's going to be happening in the future or feeling helpless about what's happened in the past. And so we can miss these incredibly beautiful moments. I remember one gentleman who was working in Silicon Valley, an engineer, and he said he used to come home every night and his kids would go, "Daddy, Daddy, listen to this," and whatever. And he said, "I have no time. I got to go get on my email, got to start doing some stuff." And all of a sudden he realized he's hardly ever listening to his kids. And then all of a sudden, and it almost chokes me up even saying this, like, couldn't he remember the last time he said, "I love you," to his children? Mm. And when he became more mindful and aware of, like, what's going on here, he decided, "I'm going to come home from work and I'm just going to be present with my kids." And, like, you couldn't create a better gift than that in this world. The gift of presence, of love, of deep listening. We're learning. Mindfulness is also a practice of listening and appreciating the richness of this person that we're with.
Wow. That's a very touching story. I'm thinking about Mighty Mouse from television many years ago. He would say, "Here I come to save the day." and that's what I was thinking about with mindfulness, because you say that mindfulness really is about gradually learning to replace stress-promoting habits with mindful ones. Is that how we can shut off that stress button in our lives? How do we do it? Tell us something about how we do it.
Well, first of all, I'll say that I don't think it's possible to shut off the stress button. And also, you know, there is some value to the stress button. You know, as you referred to, like when the saber-toothed tiger is coming at you, the fight, flight, or freeze response can be important. You know, the time when someone's stuck in somewhere and somebody picks up with Herculean effort to lift something off a person that's been stuck. And I mean, these flights of adrenaline can be very helpful in life-threatening situations. The question is, are we burning the candle on both ends? But let's make the distinction: when stress becomes distress, then our system is beginning to function with an overload and things can begin to break down. And particularly if we're not mindful, we may begin to develop maladaptive coping styles for dealing with stress, such as smoking, drinking, overworking. And I mean, there's a whole cascade of different maladaptive coping styles that we deal with stress that could eventually lead to breakdown in health from a maladaptive coping style. And so we sometimes talk about that there's a difference between reacting to stress and responding to stress.
Wow, that's a lovely explanation. Thank you so much. We're up to our first break talking today with Bob Stahl, a practitioner and teacher of mindfulness and author of a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook. And Bob, when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about emotions. You're listening to Full Power Living, and we'll be right back.
Listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes? Or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. This is Eileen Dillon, and I have a few announcements for you. We hope you'll download episodes of Full Power Living and take them along so that you can listen to the most cutting-edge information on all areas of life that are impacted by emotions that we have put together here for you at Full Power Living. You can download them from emotionalpro.com, or you can subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. Use my name, Eileen Dillon. That's I-L-E-N-E-D-I-L-L-O-N. Now let's talk about some upcoming shows. Next week, we're entering a month where we're looking at pathways that we follow to get human beings started with their lives here on the earth, child rearing. And our first guest will be Dathan Paterno, PhD, who's author of Desperately Seeking Parents. Then we have Shefali Sabari, who's also a PhD with The Conscious Parent. Lynn Austin has a charming book of wisdom called The Sun is in My Heart. And we've invited Dr. Jeffrey Mason to do a return visit with us to talk about his latest book, The Dog Who Wouldn't Stop Loving. So check the top of our radio page on emotionalpro.com. And I met the dog who's the star of that book, too. for a fuller listing of upcoming guests and their topics. And remember, too, that we've got two internet radio programs that we broadcast on the Women's Information Network, the WIN Online, thewinonline.com. I do those with my friend, life coach Dakey Fox. They are Building Conscious Families and Emotionally Speaking. And especially if you're interested in talking about emotions in your life connected to work, personal life, or the world, we invite you to contact me personally, Eileen@emotionalpro.com, and let us know, because you can participate in one of our discussions and be on that program. So finally, thank you for telling your family and friends about Full Power Living and asking them to listen with you, and for being part of our mission of awakening the world to the power and importance of human emotions. Today, we're talking with Bob Stahl, practitioner and teacher of mindfulness and co-author of a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook. Now, Bob, I know on your website, mbsrworkbook.com, you have links to all the major booksellers and people can buy the book there as well. And they can also get support for individual mindfulness, like in a community. And you have a community set up on Facebook. So will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you. We really, Elisha and I, who's the co-author, he's a psychologist in Los Angeles, we really wanted to make this book a very generous offering to the world. Due to our own love and passion of mindfulness practice within our lives, and of course, having worked with thousands of people with stress, pain, and illness, I've seen its benefits firsthand with many. And so this book is an offering to anyone living with stress, pain, and illness, and part of, within the book, there's actually an MP3 CD that has 21 different meditations. It's 15, 30, and 45-minute versions of a body scan, a sitting meditation, lying yoga, standing yoga, loving kindness meditation, which is what we use in our mindfulness-based stress reduction classes. So there's a very generous offering of over 8.5 hours of guided meditations that people can work with the book, and they can pick and select whether they want to do a 15, 30, or 45-minute version. In addition to that, we've created a Facebook community page. You know, Facebook is kind of a funny medium, and I'm not here to sell it or endorse it, but there's over 600 million people in the world that are using Facebook. This is a huge statement of people want to connect with each other. And so we decided to use Facebook as a medium where people, well, we can interact with our readers. And so we offer video blogs from time to time, as well as written blogs. And we invite people to put on the wall if they have questions about practice, and we'll answer them either by a video blog format or a written format. And so we're trying to work with, you know, supporting our readers with an interactive community of support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just yesterday I heard a statistic that women in their mid-40s had reported feeling very lonely as a result of not being able to interact and look people squarely in their eyes because they're on the internet so much. Women in their 70s didn't report that as much, but that's very interesting. And yet we get an opportunity to connect with millions of people on Facebook should they all get interested in mindfulness. That would be, wow.
Oh, yeah, it's an interesting medium. And I think there is, you know, I remember George Carlin doing some type of very powerful, wise comedy statement, which had much more depth than comedy. But he was talking about, like we can fly in the moon, but we don't know who lives across the street from us.
Right.
So there's this sense of, so Facebook, you know, in some ways are these social I don't want to pick on Facebook, these social network sites are an attempt to try to bring people that are isolated together, but in virtue of it's nothing like, you know, having a talk with your neighbor. Like, you know, we don't even know our neighbors, but, you know, perhaps because of that, it's our statement of this desire to want to connect. And, I think in mindfulness, we actually are looking in, we're working with our practice to develop our own, if you will, our intrapersonal relationship with ourselves and working with the emotions and our own woundedness, our own pains, our own way of being in the world. But also intrapersonally, there is the interpersonal, our relational connection that we have with others. So we want to bring mindfulness within us, which is called intrapersonally, and we want to bring it relationally to others, which is interpersonally. And in that way, we can begin to I think live a much more meaningful life because we're being present to ourselves and to others.
Well, you know, I just want to comment on that as a person who had a lot of challenges growing up and so forth, and then eventually became a therapist. My biggest improvement project, of course, has been myself. And as I improved myself internally, my relationships with people externally improved dramatically. And that's part of the promise of mindfulness too, is it not?
Absolutely. You know, in this powerful statement of, you know, let there be peace on earth, let it begin with me. And, you know, those saints and seers and mystics of the past, you know, it's funny, we're still talking about them, you know, 2,500, 2,000 years later. Just one person that decided to go inside their own woundedness, their own psyche, their own heart, their own soul, whatever we want to call it, and to begin to make some sense of themselves and their life and to make peace with themselves and then how they brought it to others. We're still talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, pointing the way that, you know, if we are to ever know peace, it has to begin inside us. And, you know, I remember I also grew up with a lot of grief. I had a lot of death early in my life and was very lost and very confused. And it really wasn't until I, after flunking out from college and being readmitted back in warning, that I decided for whatever reason, I can't quite understand it. I ended up taking this class in Eastern philosophy and we were assigned, the very first book was the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu of Chinese wisdom of Taoism. And I remember reading one of the 81 epigrams or poems that are in the book, and one said, there's no need to look outside your window, for everything you need to know is inside you. And I had such a moment of realization of how much of my life up to that point, I had been looking elsewhere, I had been so lost and been so confused, and if I really wanted to know something, I had to begin to finally look inside me. And that's really where my path really became much more conscious and deliberate, to begin to pay attention to what was going on in my own pain and woundedness and to begin to work with that. But it involved that journey of going into ourselves. And, you know, Mary Oliver says in the end of her most hauntingly beautiful poem, The Journey, to save the only life you could ever save, which is yourself. But it's amazing, as we begin to save ourselves and begin to heal ourselves, our impact relationally with others, people begin to kind of have a sense, like, you know, you don't have the same reactivity that you once had, you're emitting more of a peaceful feeling or just a more understanding, compassionate presence, and people begin to pick up on that.
They do. I find myself connecting with people everywhere, whether it's in the grocery store or walking down the street or whatever. You know, it's like this, like somebody I've known forever is right there, even though I may have just laid eyes on them.
Yeah.
Part of what you say in the workbook is that mindfulness practice can actually change the brain and rewire it for happiness and ease. How does it do that?
Well, actually, it's very interesting. There is growing research, particularly in the last even the 10, 15 years, neurobiology, that is beginning to, with the sophistication of the technology, the functional MRIs and so forth, neuroscientists can actually begin to look at areas of the brain and recognize where there's areas that have long been associated with stress or reactivity and see certain phenomena. As Richie Davidson, who's a neuroscientist at University of Wisconsin-Madison, says, you know, the untechnical word is seeing certain areas of the brain that light up, that are areas known to be associated with stress and reactivity. And conversely, after people going through mindfulness training, and actually there's a really amazing study done with a group of biotech workers. These weren't Tibetan monks. These are people who were working in a biotech company outside of Madison, Wisconsin, and they did a pre and a post MRIs with these participants of a mindfulness program, and they also did a control group that they compared, and they found that those that went through the mindfulness program, that the areas associated with having more of a positive response to stress lit up much more than those that didn't. And so actually the term that they use is that what's happening is there's neuroplasticity, that actually through the thoughts that we think, it can create different brain structures within the brain, which is really kind of blow your mind away. But neuroscience is actually beginning to back this up, that you can begin to see through these functional MRI scans areas of the brain change and change in very positive ways when we are feeding, just like going back, which dog are you feeding? And so we're learning that, you know, if we begin to feed the positive side of that, we can develop more resiliency. Another effect of that study was that they did with the biotech workers in a control group, each of them got a flu shot before the mindfulness-based stress reduction program, and then they took it afterwards, and then 3 months further down the road, and they found that those that had meditated, they had a much more robust response to in their immune system from the flu vaccination, which is, you know, pointing that meditation also has some powerful effects on the immune system, so not just like in brain function, but also in the immune system. And of course, mindfulness is being studied in many different areas with different illnesses and chronic pain and anxiety. A colleague of mine, Philippe Goulden at Stanford, is just completed a study of people living with social anxiety disorder and doing functional MRIs both pre and post, and those that were practicing mindfulness, that you could, you know, he would actually have slides of the brain images from the functional MRIs and show various areas of the brain where people were reporting feeling better with their stress and their anxiety, particularly their anxiety, and those areas of the brain were lit up more than the parts that were having a lot of counterproductive aspects within the brain. So this very fascinating cutting-edge research that is going on in, actually there's a field of neuroscience, Richie Davidson's one of the foremost leaders in this field, called affective neuroscience, and that we can begin to, you know, through practice, through development of the mind and the heart, we can, there's evidence showing structures of brain changes in a much more positive way.
Is that effective with an E or an A?
I'm sorry, with my Boston accent, it could go either way, right? with an A.
Uh-huh.
Affective neuroscience.
Good. Thank you for that.
Read it, just Google Richie Davidson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and there's a whole body of literature. Also, Daniel Siegel, who wrote The Mindful Brain, is a psychiatrist and neurobiologist, and so doing a lot of work with the study of mindfulness and meditation and brain physiology.
Great, thank you. Now, one of the things I want to do is get some information about emotions. So a big part of stress today is fear. And I know that one of the things that you're recommending is the loving kindness meditation. Tell us a little bit about how mindfulness can help us with fear.
Well, first of all, like mindfulness, let me just, since you mentioned loving kindness, you know, this is a very important practice, and this is one of the ways that we can work with fear. There's other ways, but well, let's just consider that mindfulness is like bringing light to what's present. And what we found is that by actually, and this is going to sound paradoxical perhaps to many, and I'll use a metaphor. When I was 16 years old, I grew up in the Boston area, and there was a new driver driving in the snow-laced roads of Boston and New England. And when I would get in the skid, my first impulse would be to turn away from the skid because it was scary. And the more that I turned away, the more that I continued to skid out. And it wasn't until my dad said, you know, Bob, if you want to get out of the skid, you're going to have to turn into it. And when I first heard that, I thought that was crazy. That scared me. Turn into the place that I'm scared of? Are you kidding? And eventually, I just was not able to get out of that skid by turning away from it, and I began to turn into it. And lo and behold, it was like a revelation to some degree. I realized that my car began to straighten out, and it was by turning into the skid. It planted a powerful seed within me that if I begin to turn into my fears, I can overcome them, I can work with them. And I think mindfulness in some ways works from a similar parallel. There's an old, it's a beautiful saying from a poem from Jennifer Wellwood called Unconditional. It says, whatever you flee from, it's going to pursue you. Whatever you welcome will begin to transform you. Which is, again, the sense of that welcoming is that turning into what's present. So I know for many of us, it's very scary to turn into our fears. And at first, when we begin to turn into them, sometimes they can actually even feel like they're amplifying, they're getting bigger. And we need to know that, because the reason that's happening is because we're bringing our attention to it. And that's at the point where mostly we exit the stage, right, and don't want to have anything to do with it. But what we can begin to learn in mindfulness is to dip our toes in and out into the fear, is being mindful and acknowledging what's arising in our bodies, thoughts, and emotions. And in time, through this dipping out, just like you'd dip your toes into a cold water, but you want to go swimming, but gradually in time, your toes have begun to play in the water. You've acclimated yourself to your temperature. So in a similar way, we begin to work with fear by acknowledging the fear, beginning to dip in and dip out, learning how to give space to the fear. Another metaphor we use is like the sky is made of air. And even when there's a category 1, 2, 3, 4 hurricane storm, because the sky is made of air, the air never really receives any ill effects from the storm. It just gives the storm space. And in that space, gradually, that storm begins to dissipate from a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and so forth. And mindfulness is quality of non-judgmental awareness. We're learning how to weather the different fear, sad, angry, different emotional storms within us. And by acknowledging what's present, and we'll come to see that as we bring our energy into going with what's happening, rather than fighting it, things will begin to run their course. Dana Falls, another poet, she says, resist and the tides will sweep you off your feet. Allow, and grace will carry you to higher ground. Allow, great. And grace will carry you to higher ground. And so there's a sense of, in mindfulness, that we begin to work with the fears that are arising within us physically, mentally, emotionally, and allowing ourselves to acknowledge them, give them space to run their course. Of course, I don't want to sound too macho. If it feels like it's too much, certainly fine to get up, go for a walk, go watch I Love Lucy, take care of yourself, do whatever you need to do. But there's an old saying, you can run, but you can't ever hide. And so sometimes distraction is suitable and right. But if we're constantly distracting ourselves, the fear will just follow us wherever we go. So we're learning to move into it when we begin to develop our mindfulness skills. And just like a candle in the darkness of the night, when illuminated, dispels the darkness all around it. As we talk about this loving kindness practice, when we begin to develop these qualities of loving kindness, which is a very boundless type of aspect of love.
Wonderful.
This also can begin to dispel the fears around us. How can fear stay when love is there, when we're feeling safe, when we're feeling connected and interconnected to ourselves and the world?
Mm-hmm. It really can't. So we've come up to our second break here. And when we come back, Bob, I would like you to talk about why you believe that a lack of self-compassion is the great unnamed epidemic. We're talking today with Bob Stahl, who is the author of a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook. You're listening to Full Power Living, and I'm your host, Eileen Dillon. We'll be right back.
Listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger, but if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. With Bob Stahl, who's practitioner and teacher of mindfulness and author of a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook. And you can find him at mbsrworkbook.com. You can get a copy of the workbook and find out a whole lot of other things and join with the community that they have on Facebook to help you with developing your own mindfulness-based practice. So, Bob, before the break, I asked, why is it that you're saying that self-compassion is the great unnamed epidemic, and how does mindfulness help with this epidemic?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a very important question, and it's been my observation, and I've worked teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction over 19 years, and no doubt many people come for many different reasons living with stress, pain, and illness, as well as those who want to improve their health and their well-being. So we work with a very wide range of people. But what I find over and over and over again, and I would say it's like up to like about 99.9% of the time, just about, that what really things come down to is this inner voice that we have within us that somehow feels that we're not measuring up, that we're not good enough, that we're flawed, inadequate, deficient, unworthy, filled with shame. There is so many descriptors of self-loathing, this sense of being hard on ourselves, being critical, judgmental, the incredible amount of lack of self-compassion that we have for ourselves. And of course, in our society and culture, we're often taught to be selfless and not to be selfish. We do not have hardly any words. You know, we have a word called self-care, self-caring, but we don't have that many words about caring for our own hearts, to open to compassion for ourselves. And I see so many of us have this sense of this inner critic and judge that's kind of, you know, relentlessly commenting on what we look like, what we're doing, what we did, what we didn't do, what we should do. And so I think that this is incredibly prevalent for so many of us, is this feeling of not being enough. And so mindfulness, I just want to acknowledge that and to name that, that this is something that is so common, so pervasive in our culture, in our times. And actually, I think it's really spread worldwide. And so I think the first step is to recognize this part of ourselves that, that won't give ourselves a break, that's hard on ourselves, and to begin with these practices of reconciliation. And I like to often use the term hindsight wisdom. So as we look back now and where we were then, we can see much more clearly why we did what we did, because often it was fueled by our own unawareness and our own fears. And maybe we were told when we were young that we were never going to amount up to anything. We're carrying messages that we learned when we were still developing our personality that sometimes we'll call the narrative-based self. And we begin to reenact this old woundedness from early, at times, early childhood. Woundings that get reinforced as we grow up. We're not accepted by other kids. We're not liked. And, you know, there's lots of things that come in the way that feed and fuel the sense of being hard on ourselves, being critical and judgmental. The first step is to be aware that we actually are carrying this. Many of us don't even know this. We're just reacting in these ways. Once we become aware of it, we can begin to make some positive changes. We can begin to acknowledge or bring inquiry and investigation and how these voices came about. Sometimes we use what's called mindful self-inquiry, and people begin to discover. There was a gentleman I was working with, he was going to be getting married, and he was complaining of a lot of panic and anxiety arising, which is, of course, normal. It's a big life change. But as we applied this mindful self-inquiry, he felt into his physical feelings of angst and kept on following what was arising, coming up to him physically, mentally, emotionally. And in the silence, he recalled very early in his life of him doing homework and his parents saying, this isn't right, you got to do it this way. And then bringing it to school and the teacher saying, no, you got to do it that way. And somehow he was beginning to recognize that these early childhood messages, that somehow his authentic self wasn't good enough, and that when he was getting married, that his future wife was going to really find out the truth that he wasn't good enough. And the recognition that this came from very early learnings, when, of course, we couldn't help ourselves. And so this type of inquiry, as well as hindsight wisdom, to begin to recognize these different messages that we somehow have assimilated and kept them to be our own. And this is called self-referencing. We keep on self-referencing. And the only way that we can begin to break these patterns is to develop self-awareness. And with awareness, we can begin to break this referencing. We can begin to understand where this came from. We can begin to develop some reconciliation, some compassion for our own shortcomings, our own imperfections. We begin to see and understand that what we did in the past was fueled by our own unawareness, by our own fears. And now that I'm, you know, I can understand this more, and this understanding can begin to set us free. This understanding begins to help us also recognize how that perhaps I've been cruel or hard or, you know, or caused pain to others, that I was lashing out over my own fears and my own unawareness and my own, you know, angers. And then, of course, it can grow even further to even begin to understand and have reconciliation for those that have hurt me, that it was out of their own woundedness, their own fears, their own unawareness that caused them to strike out and hurt me. And we can begin to experience profound reconciliation.
That's really important. So let me, I just want to bring our listeners' attention to your book, A Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook. And essentially, you can take 11 weeks of your life and go through this workbook and follow the formal and informal practices of mindfulness and move yourself toward mindfulness. And the question I have for you, Bob, is, you know, I have another program called Building Conscious Families, and we're aiming to help people develop or set up for having families of the future, for being prepared and being participatory in how things may be quite different in our future. And so I'm wondering if you think being mindful might be part of the family curriculum for the future, if you will.
Oh, I get goosebumps just hearing that. And the answer is a big, huge yes. And and actually, I'll just take a step back. Even though it's some of the advertising for our book is incorrect, 11 weeks is not the adequate number. We consider mindfulness to be a way of life, and one can look at this book and begin the practices right away and begin to feel and experience its results. It's not an 11-week program, so I just want to set the facts straight, and you didn't know that because it was written in the media press of the media.
That's true.
We're working on correcting that. But as far as mindfulness with families, I actually have a colleague of mine. She's at the UCSF, and she's developed a whole mindfulness-based childbirth and parenting program. Another colleague of mine has begun what's called mindful schools, bringing mindfulness into kindergarten through 12th grade schools. They've started working in Oakland for the last few years and is now spreading out to many other cities and places. Mindfulness and working with children is a hot topic. And begin to teach children skills to learn how to center themselves, learn how to become more present, learn how to respond rather than react is a fundamental building block to potentially building a more peaceful and caring and loving society. And, I mean, you know, actually, it's very funny. I mean, some people might call this as Pollyanna, but deep down, we're all wanting peace. We want to try to get along. And, you know, there's a wonderful question that I read in a graffiti in a toilet once. It said, peace and love is the answer. What is the question? And so, but teaching our children, you know, we teach our children not to hit each other, but to use your words to talk, to express what you're feeling. And if we can begin to bring a more intentional teaching of being more present, using our words, like developing mindful communication skills, listening more deeply to each other, these are all ways to prevent wars, and also to build cooperation or competition and to share what we have rather than take as just for our own. And so I think that mindfulness has a very important role for our children. It's for our future.
Yes, I certainly agree.
Our future. If we want to build a world that has more kindness and compassion, let it begin with our children and with ourselves.
I had a very powerful experience 2 years ago when my youngest grandchild was born. I was present for her birth, and she had a very difficult birth, and her Apgar score was very low. And they placed her in a little bassinet to recuperate once they got her breathing and so forth. And my son asked me to please be with her because I tend to talk to babies very early on. And she was all hooked up to all kinds of monitors, and they were checking on her oxygen saturation level and her bloodstream and her breathing rate and her temperature and all these kinds of things. There was a nurse full-time sitting there reading these reports. And I decided that in addition to welcoming her to the planet, which I usually do, and orienting her, this is where you are, these are the people that are around you and so forth, I decided to address the emotional issue of the difficult birth. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that she would be feel like she was unsafe because of that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I started talking to her about how she was safe now, mm-hmm. and that all she needed to do was to regulate her breathing and occupy her body, and she would be fine, that she was safe. And within a minute of the time I started talking to her, the nurse looked up and said, whatever you're doing, keep it up. Everything just went to normal.
Wow. Yeah, I love hearing this. And there's a certain, like, this empathic resonance. In the old hippie days, we used to call it attunement and resonance. And now a neurobiologist, Dan Siegel, who's a psychiatrist, is using the same exact terms of attunement and resonance, of one human being connecting with another, and it's like a tuning fork, and we can begin to connect. And this sense of connection is so vital to our health and our well-being. And, you know, it might be funny to say, but as my son was being born, he was still in the birth canal, I was talking with him there. And I was saying, Ben, I just want to let you know you're in a tight place right now, and you're going to be being born soon. And I just want to let you know where you are and just to go with it. He tried to help him with his going through his birth canal. But like that sense of I was wanting to connect with him and letting him know this is what's happening. You're being born and you're going through a very tight place. You have a different ways that you could respond to this situation. But my suggestion is just let you know you're in a tight place and we're coming to see you soon.
Oh, great. That's really wonderful. Well, that's such a great place to start with mindfulness. And unfortunately, our time is up now, and we're going to have to draw this to a close. So let me remind you that we've been talking with Bob Stahl. He's the co-author, along with Elisha Goldstein, of a mindfulness-based stress reduction workshop, which is certainly worth your time and energy to explore. So, Bob, I want to thank you for bringing mindfulness in such a usable and accessible way, and I also really appreciate you taking time to talk with us here at Full Power Living today.
Thank you, Eileen, and I actually really have appreciated our conversation. It felt very personal and relatable and connectable, and I just very much appreciate the work that you're doing, and, you know, I really want to honor that, you know, working through the media and getting these things out to a wider group of people is a very noble endeavor. So thank you very much, and appreciated your kindness and questions and just talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you. The feeling is mutual. All right. And thank you, too, to our wonderful producer, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host here at Full Power Living, reminding you, pay attention to what you want to become and not to what you want to overcome.
Listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.